Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. You may know it as DACA. You may know them as Dreamers. Today, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the U.S. plans to stop protecting from deportation people who were brought here illegally as children.
To have a lawful system of immigration that serves the national interest, we cannot admit everyone who would like to come here. It's just that simple. That would be an open borders policy, and the American people have rightly rejected that. Therefore, the nation must set and enforce a limit on how many immigrants we admit each year, and that means all cannot be accepted. This does not mean they are bad people or that our nation disrespects or demeans them in any way. It means we are properly enforcing our laws as Congress has passed them.
In other words, if Congress wants to protect those childhood arrivals, it'll have to change the law, and Congress has 6 months to do that. Now what? NPR politics editor Domenico Montanaro, thanks for joining us again.
Hey there, thank you for having me.
Does Congress want to protect childhood arrivals?
That depends on who you ask.
Yeah, what are they saying?
You know, House Speaker Paul Ryan issued a very sympathetic statement to the folks known as Dreamers, as children who've been brought to the United States, without their knowledge, as children, sometimes as babies. But he didn't have a very strong urgency for action. He said that he hopes that Congress will act, and tried to sort of walk this line between what President Trump is calling for here and Congress actually taking action. And I find it ironic, given that President Trump is sending this back to Congress and wants to see action from them over the next 6 months, when President Obama actually acted because of congressional inaction. And frankly, it's difficult to see how this will get done in the next 6 months when the first Dreamer bill was actually introduced some 15 years ago. So something that hasn't been able to be done in 15 years, President Trump wants them to do in the next 6 months and hasn't given them much direction on what his preference is.
So, Domenico, you didn't use the word prediction, but between Paul Ryan's weak support and the legislative calendar, do you think Congress does not legislate DACA and it goes away in 6 months?
I'll make this prediction. It won't happen in the next month.
Yeah.
You know, it's a full calendar that Congress has. It has 12 legislative days to get some big things done, including raising the debt limit, getting that Hurricane Harvey relief funding passed, which they might tie the two together, and try to avoid a government shutdown. You know, these are things that should be basically business as usual, but getting three big items like that done within 12 legislative days is going to make things awfully difficult. You know, President Trump also dropped this on the laps of Republican leaders when really what the priority had been was after September to try to get tax reform done, another huge item that hasn't been addressed in the last 30 years. So how you're going to get all of those things accomplished, it's very unclear that they actually will.
Well, help me understand that lap dropping. Is President Trump lobbying Congress to allow Dreamers to stay, or is he lobbying Congress to let Dreamers be deported?
Yeah, call me a skeptic on this, but he may be trying to have it both ways. Mm. I think that, you know, his rhetoric during the campaign was such that he said, you know, even back in April, he said that Dreamers should rest easy. And Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, was the face of this announcement today, not President Trump. So he really wasn't putting his own credibility directly behind it. And by passing it to Congress, he's setting himself again up for the ability or possibility of separating himself from Congress when it makes an odious political decision.
Well, I didn't hear all of Attorney General Sessions' statement. What did he call on Congress to do? Did he say one way or the other, this is what Congress must do?
No, and that's not really the role of the attorney general. So, you know, Jeff Sessions was known as a pretty hardline immigration guy in the Senate. So we know where he would have stood as a senator from Alabama. But as attorney general, his point was that this is actually unconstitutional, that this was presidential overreach by President Obama. He called it President Obama's, attempt at amnesty. And so he was trying to keep this framed within the legal framework. And there is some argument to the fact that that most legal scholars and experts thought that this was doomed in court. And frankly, President Obama himself never intended this to be a permanent item. He said that he felt that he was doing this because Congress didn't act, that it's only a short-term thing, that he hopes that Congress does get something done, but they never took it up.
When the Republicans failed to repeal and replace Obamacare, one reason we heard was that Obamacare is too popular. How popular is the DACA protection?
The DACA protection is fairly popular. If you ask most people, including Republicans, whether or not they think that children who were brought to the U.S. without their knowledge, who speak English, who go to college, who might be in the military, if they support that program and keeping folks here, they do, including Republicans. So this is a difficult thing for Republicans to have to balance, but deep down, the Republican base, there's no bigger wedge issue than immigration for them. They feel like they want to hold a hard line on this. They don't want to make any kind of concession that could lead to something else. And I did think it was kind of interesting listening to Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary today, saying that, you know, you shouldn't govern with emotions. You know, while the president might be emotional about this, that's not a way to govern. And I think that there's a serious debate that will likely ensue with that kind of a statement, because I think that there are a lot of people who get into politics to right injustices, to right wrongs that they see, that they do get emotionally attached to, that they see something that they think is bad and wrong, and that's why they get involved, and that's why they want to make a change. So a very interesting calculation to say that you should be sort of cool and calm about something that certainly affects a lot of people's lives and make a decision that doesn't have some basis in emotion.
Finally, Domenico, we've been talking about politicians a lot. Let's get back to the people most affected. Since we don't know what the politicians will do, what does this planned phase out mean for those childhood arrivals?
Well, for now, they're stuck in some kind of a limbo, frankly. I mean, if it were to expire in 6 months and Congress doesn't act and we go back to sort of a pre-DACA world, which was essentially these folks living in the shadows, no one knowing where they are or who they are. The difference now is that the government has the best database they've ever had of where they are. So if the president actually did want to ramp up deportations, he certainly would be more well positioned now than he was before, than the government was before these folks signed up for DACA. So right now, if anybody wanted to come in after today, they can't sign up anymore. They can't try to get this DACA protection. And, you know, they're sitting there waiting and hoping that that Congress can act, because right now, as Americans, you know, many of these kids do consider themselves obviously Americans because they've known nothing else, which is something that former President Obama said in his statement today, that this action is contrary to our spirit and to common sense. And he said these dreamers are Americans in their hearts and their minds in every single way but one on paper. And he called this self-defeating, cruel, and wrong, and a political decision. So for these kids, you know, it's a predicament for them, because they're going to be in a situation where they can't apply for driver's licenses, they can't apply for jobs on the books, and they're in a very difficult position, which is why the program, people on both sides generally agree that there has to be some kind of fix here.
Okay, so the DACA program is closed for now, and we wait for Congress to respond in the midst of so many other things Congress is dealing with right now. That's NPR Politics editor Domenico Montanaro joining us again. Nice to talk to you again. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Now, how about some local reaction to the end of DACA? We have Liz Jones here with KUOW's immigration team. Hi, Liz.
Hello, Bill.
How many people could be directly affected by this in Washington State?
Well, in our state, there are 43,000 individuals who are eligible for the DACA program. Not all of those have applied. Of those, there are about 18,000 who have been approved for DACA, who are currently enjoying the benefits of the DACA program. These are people who are currently in high school, have finished high school, finished college, are out working in our tech industry and academia and various jobs here in our region.
Yes, thousands of job holders. How could this affect Washington State's economy if the DACA program goes away and these workers and residents can no longer stay?
Yeah, it's estimated about 90% of DACA holders work in our state. So we've heard from Governor Jay Inslee that This would mean about $1 billion loss to our economy annually if these workers were to be removed from Washington State. So when you talk about who's affected by that, by DACA ending, it's these individuals, the DACA holders, it's their families, it's their coworkers, it's their schoolmates, it's a lot of people in our community.
What have you been hearing from DACA recipients here?
Well, they've been braced for this for months.
We know, thanks to your good reporting on this for months.
Thank you. But really, since President Trump was elected, this was a possibility, and they knew that. So they've been ready for this. They've been finding ways to cope, a lot of them online, in social groups with friends, just kind of trying to stay positive, sharing their diplomas, sharing pictures of the cars that they've been able to buy with their jobs through DACA. But I attended a dinner last night with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal here from Seattle with about a dozen DACA recipients, or those who are eligible for DACA. They were emotional, but also resolved to keep fighting and strategizing how they're going to advocate in the weeks and the months ahead. And we spoke with a young man named Paul Quiñones. He's a DACA recipient, originally from Mexico, came here when he was 7 years old. He's now 22. And this is what he had to say.
I think it's a broken promise to our community. He said that he was going to treat us with heart. But in reality, knowing that our lives are going to be thrown into chaos in 6 months is not treating us with heart, is not any comfort to us. And so we think that this is the easy way out, the logical solution. If he truly does want us to have a legislative solution to our problems, the logical solution would be for him to leave DACA intact without a deadline until it is addressed in Congress.
So Paul Quiñones, he currently works as a legislative aide in Olympia. We also asked him how his life would change if DACA comes to an end in 6 months.
For my life, it would mean that I would lose my job. I would lose my ability to pay for my rent. I would lose my benefits that come attached to my job. I'm very fortunate enough to now have healthcare provided by my work. I would lose access to that. And so it would really put me in a really, and many other people like me, in a really unfortunate situation. And it would leave us unable to put all the skills that we've gained to work.
And obviously another huge change is that he could be deported. This is something that these young people were talking about last night. You can imagine a dinner here with a congresswoman. There are Caesar salads in front of them on the table. They're just wilting. Nobody's touching their food. They know this is a real reality for them and their families.
And what, Liz Jones, are local and state political leaders saying about this?
Yeah, you can imagine there's been an avalanche of press comments and statements in my inbox this morning from our state attorney general, from Congress members, local leaders. Pramila Jayapal, last night's event, she said she thinks there's enough support in Congress to pass a bill that would protect these DACA recipients and potentially offer them a path to legalization. She's a Democrat, but she said it's a very fluid and quickly evolving issue in Congress right now.
Honestly, I think views have changed so much, and you see it with the CEOs coming out for DACA and, you know, all of the economic impacts that have been shown to be the case. The devastation to the economy if the program were ended, I think all of those things are positive factors for Republicans who perhaps were not previously on it to be on it today.
And Liz, what about some Republicans? What are they saying?
Yeah, Republicans. We've heard from Republican Dave Reichert, Representative Dave Reichert. He's currently co-sponsored two bills that would protect DACA recipients. One is the Bridge Act that would give a 3-year protection to DACA eligible individuals. Another is an act that would give them a way to gain legal status here. He said that punishing these individuals, quote, is not in the American DNA. We also heard from Eastern Washington Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers. She reiterated that she does not support how DACA came about through Obama's executive action, but she said it's clear that we have to work together in Congress to provide long-term certainty to DACA recipients. So she didn't give any specifics, but said she's committed to working with her colleagues on this issue.
And of course, we have the Washington Attorney General. Right. Poised to get involved.
Right. They're all there. And he issued a statement yesterday, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, saying that he will file a lawsuit to defend the DACA recipients, to defend this program. He expects other AGs across the country will join in with him on this effort. And we've already heard from New York Attorney General on the same position. And we'll hear more from Attorney General Bob Ferguson later today at a press conference.
And we're hearing from our local tech leaders in the Puget Sound area, too, right?
Right. They've been coming out in the recent weeks talking about the economic hurt that this would cause, how DACA recipients are integrated into their companies, into our economy, into our communities. Microsoft's Brad Smith said it's a big step back for our entire country, and that he's calling on Congress to make changes to its legislative calendar to get DACA, to take action on DACA now.
Finally, Liz, what happens next locally on this issue?
Well, as I mentioned, we're seeing dreamers coming together, talking about how to strategize in the weeks ahead, how to lobby their Congress members to get quick action on this with so many other things on the legislative agenda. We're hearing from Congress members saying they're going back to D.C. this week, and they're going to talk to their colleagues to figure out which bill they can get behind and which one has a real chance to get a vote and get passed. And then we'll watch what happens in court. There are various lawsuits that have been threatened. We'll see what happens there.
That is KOW reporter Liz Jones from our immigration team reporting on today's announcement from the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. The U.S. plans to stop protecting from deportation people brought here illegally as kids. Liz, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up on KOW's The Record, you've seen the smoke outside. It's like a giant cloche has been placed over the region, like God is playing molecular gastronomy and we are her smoked langoustine cotton candy duck balloons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
I didn't make that up. That was Lindy West in the New York Times, Seattle author. And in just a moment, Lindy West and I and you are going to hang out. Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. A few weeks ago when Seattle was smoky and hot, New York Times columnist Lindy West wrote, "All week I have stared at the low, dirty sky and thought, what if this never left? What if it got worse?" And what do you know? I'm peering through smoke at Lindy West right now. I can just make her out. Hi, Lindy.
Hi, how's it going?
Thanks for coming back. Good to see you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It took 3 weeks after your column to get to smoky and hot again. Are you feeling depressed or triumphant? And please be honest.
What's more than depressed? Deep existential dread and despair. No, I mean, this is worse because now there is a gentle coating of ash falling down from the sky and the sun is large and blood red. And I mean, I just couldn't feel more apocalyptic.
Are climate change scientists saying that the Puget Sound area is going to be more smoky and apocalyptic from now on?
I don't know.
But it feels that way.
I mean, every climate change article you read is basically like everything you can imagine is about to happen. And, you know, we're all going to suffocate under a ash blanket. So
under a cloche, if you will. I want to thank you for one. This is one of my three favorite Lindy West New York Times sentences. This is about the smoke. It's as though a giant cloche has been placed over the whole region, like God is playing molecular gastronomy, and we are her smoked langoustine cotton candy duck balloons. Number one, people don't say cloche enough.
I agree. I got a lot of mail about that line.
Really?
Yeah, I guess other people don't watch as much Food Network as I do.
Okay.
Made perfect sense to me, but a lot of New York Times readers let me know that was the biggest pile of nonsense that they'd ever heard in their lives.
Wait a minute, because scientifically or gastronomically?
No, just the metaphor.
What? I thought it was great.
Thank you.
But where did it come from? Like, why would smoke make you think of any of those words?
Well, because they always do that. They always do that thing on like fancy, you know, when people try to get real ambitious on Chopped, they'll take a little cloche and fill it with smoke so that when you lift it, you get a big cloud of smoke in your face like that.
I didn't know that.
Well, see, there you go. I probably shouldn't have put it in the newspaper because it lives only in my brain, apparently.
I didn't even know what langoustine was.
It's like a shrimp lobster.
Yeah. Bon Appetit magazine called it the new foie gras.
Oh, really?
I only know because I looked it up because of your New York Times sentence.
See, that's what I'm saying. It's not that hard to do a little bit of research. A food savant like me puts a very, very complicated and apt metaphor in the New York Times. Just do a little Googling.
But you know what I haven't Googled because I want to know from you if it's a real thing. What are a smoked langoustine cotton candy duck balloons? What part of that is real?
That's nonsense.
Okay.
No, it's just a bunch of like trendy food terms that I stuck together pretending like it was all one thing.
Cotton candy doesn't really go with any of that.
No, but people... Okay, you have to start watching more food television.
I need to, yeah.
It's a you can make cotton candy out of anything, apparently.
Really?
I mean, I don't know why you would want to, but there's all you can
lobster cotton candy if I wanted to.
If anyone wants to develop a recipe for smoked langoustine cotton candy duck balloons, did I forget anything? Please do and let me know.
You own a piece of that now, though, right?
Oh, that's true. You'll have to pay me.
Yes. yeah, I learned a lot about it at Bon Appetit. As soon as langoustines die, their delicate flesh begins to auto-consume, turning black, mealy, and disgusting.
What?
Yep. I learned that if you eat it in Seattle, it was probably overnighted live from Iceland in an individual container because just looking at other langoustines stresses them out, which could compromise the quality of their meat.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I wish I had known that. Now I feel like I want to incorporate langoustine into every metaphor.
Please do. Lindy West writes a New York Times column now, besides being the author of Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. Did you send your clips to the New York Times? How did that go down?
No, I've just been writing for a long time. I started in Seattle. I moved to Jezebel, which is a feminist blog, and then to GQ, then to The Guardian. So I just sort of been around and, I caught the eye of an editor and she reached out and...
The New York Times just cold called you?
They kind of just cold called me.
Wow. What was that phone call like?
It was an email and I think it was very like unassuming and it didn't feel real.
Uh-huh.
And then, they didn't just offer me a column. It was like, I did a couple of one-off little freelance pieces for them throughout the election. It was terrifying. I literally started my career at The Stranger in Seattle, like writing, you know, poop jokes about about movies. So
langoustine poop. I have the clip right here. It's in front of me.
So suddenly to be trusted with that kind of a platform and that level of credibility was very intimidating. But, when presented with such an opportunity, what can you do but try to rise to the occasion as best you can?
And what's it been like? What's it like being a New York Times columnist?
Well, technically, I'm a contributing opinion writer.
Oh.
Columnist is, I do have a column, but columnist is like one level of fancy above me.
Uh-huh.
Maybe several levels, I don't know. But
contributing
opinion writer.
Opinion writer, okay.
But no, I mean it's really been incredible. It's been really, really fulfilling. It's a little bit the comment sections are still comment sections. But how is it different? It does feel a little bit less hostile and I don't know if I want to go there. Maybe I've just made myself less accessible. I'm not on Twitter anymore. I tend to ignore it. But it just feels like you can actually make a complex point and people will listen to you, which is a rare feeling.
Okay. So I was wondering if you're making polite elitist New York Times reading liberals uncomfortable and they're saying and they're masking that in fancy language, or do you feel like it's a different, you're writing for a different kind of person?
Probably the first thing. Yeah. No, I mean, it's a combination. I don't know. I think I don't know how the comment culture works at the New York Times. I don't know how moderated it is. I just know that the kind of hate mail that I get sounds less like angry 14-year-old boys and more like angry 80-year-old boys.
Yeah. Yep. That's about it. That's about
which
what,
is
what I was imagining.
Marginally more pleasant.
did they tell you that they wanted you to be anyway? Like, do they have, has the New York Times slotted you in as, you know, this is our so-and-so person?
Oh, that's a good question. I think they're definitely making an effort to elevate women's voices and some more diverse voices, especially since the election, where, you know, obviously identity politics are at the forefront of every conversation. And, I feel like, yeah, I mean, I'm partially there to talk, unapologetically about things like abortion and, things that maybe men are not so comfortable touching. I don't know. I mean,
what would that be besides abortion?
Oh, I don't know. Probably just abortion and then all the bad things that men do.
I'm less comfortable with that than with some other things.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, I guess I'm the abortion and what's it called when you, what's the opposite of misogyny? Misandry. I'm the abortion and misandry columnist.
I see. Do they tell you to go hard on Trump?
No. I'm really not getting any kind of, I have a lot of freedom to pitch whatever I want.
Okay.
I do end up writing about Trump over and over again because how can you not?
Yeah.
How can you not? I mean, it's terrifying. You know, every time I sit down to pitch, I think like, oh, maybe I'll write something fun this week. And then there's some new, you know, calamity barreling down on us. And it's like, okay, well, I guess it's this column again.
What are the fun pitches you never get to?
I mean, I'm not very fun anymore. I'm like, maybe today I can think of something fun.
Okay.
I mean, do you feel fun anymore?
Well, our social media producer, Bon Huberman, is sitting right next to me shaking her head. So I guess I'm not fun anymore.
I did last week. I got to write a fun one, but it was still Trump related. But I got to make fun of Mnuchin's wife and her Instagram gaffe.
For those who haven't heard, she posted a photo of herself looking fancy, coming off a government jet, and hashtag all the fancy clothes she was wearing.
Yeah, and she was like, had a great day trip to Kentucky. Buy my Birkin bag for $20,000,
mm-hmm.
Which people found to be in poor taste.
Oddly enough. Some people objected on Twitter.
And then she was kind of blindsided by that. She was like, what?
Yes. She was taken quite by surprise.
Yeah. So that was fun. But, you know, again, it's a small comfort in the scheme of things.
You wrote that when Trump won the election, quote, Republicans wrapped their arms around his meaty torso and held on for dear life. Were you fat shaming Donald Trump?
Oh, my God. I mean, someone yelled at me about that on my Facebook. I don't know. It just seemed evocative of what he's like. I have a meaty torso. There's nothing wrong with having a meaty torso.
You were just being descriptive.
I was being descriptive. I was trying to evoke a picture of like little kids wrapping their arms around their daddy's waist. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like big, big, meaty dad, little squalling toddlers.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Maybe if
that reads as fat shaming, I apologize.
Well, for listeners who don't know, I would call you a national leader in fat acceptance,
Thank
right?
Thank you. I try to use my platform for things that matter to me. And as a fat person, I try to normalize bodies like mine. I think we spend a lot of time putting people's bodies into a hierarchy and deciding how much value people have based on how conventionally attractive they are. So, yeah, I mean, I write about that a lot because I think it's just the decent thing to do.
You know, one thing I loved of yours was your writing about your fantastic wedding.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, that was the point, the thrust of it, right? Was that I had a great wedding and I was totally fat.
Yeah, totally fat the whole time. Yeah, you know,
the whole time.
It's amazing. As soon as my husband and I posted on, you know, just mentioned on Facebook that you're engaged. I don't even know if we said it specifically, you know, said it explicitly. It's like if you post a picture of a box with a ring in it or something,
uh-huh.
Facebook knows because of, you know,
an algorithm.
Yeah, which is terrifying. And then you're bombarded with targeted ads for bridal boot camp and, you know, weight loss pills and, you know, because the idea is that you have to look like the best version of yourself at your wedding. And in our culture, the best version of yourself is the skinniest version of yourself. And I just find that really disturbing. And I think it creates, you know, I know so many women, especially after I wrote about my wedding, women wrote to me and, you know, they said for years I've hated looking at my own wedding photos because I felt like I didn't get thin enough for my wedding. And I was so self-conscious in my dress and I hated having my picture taken because I felt fat. And it, you know, it ruined my wedding. And my God, what a waste of energy and what a tragedy for people who are, you know, on a day when you're supposed to be celebrating love and your future, and also for a party that you're spending a lot of money on, you should be able to go have fun. And so I didn't want to spend the year leading up to my wedding on a diet, making myself miserable so that I could look like something other than what I actually look like in these photos. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, my husband and I spent the year before our wedding traveling and, you know, eating and drinking and partying and running around and living a really fun, vibrant life. And I don't regret that at all.
It's a beautiful piece. It's funny. It's sad. It's relatable. It's like all that stuff, right? Why you read stuff. And so to our social media producer, I highly suggest we find and tweet that out at KOW. And I'm talking, by the way, with Lindy West, author of Shrill and author of a New York Times column. She's not a New York Times columnist. She is a New York Times contributing opinion writer.
Correct.
Yeah. I don't really care, but just want to get that right. Okay, another favorite Lindy West New York Times sentence. Quote, "There might be freedom and love and audacity in the weft of our national fabric, but hate and bigotry are in the warp." No idea.
I had to do a lot of research for that one.
Did you?
So the warp, so this is weaving terminology.
Yes.
So the warp are the vertical threads.
Yeah.
Right? That go up, yeah, and then the weft goes in and out of the warp.
But the idea has to come before the research. Like, did you say?
Yeah, I mean, what I wanted to say is that there are certain through lines you can't take. There's no America without slavery. You know, there's no America as we know it right now without the forced unpaid labor of Black people. And, you know, people want to think of that as the weft. You know, people want to think of that as horizontal and in the past, and we've moved on from it. And it's not. It's the warp. It's one of the, fundamental defining characteristics of this country that we have yet to really reckon with and mend. So that was my concept.
And it's the warp. That was good, Lindy West.
Thank you.
You should be a writer. Number three, 19 hyenas and a broken vacuum cleaner controlled the White House and ICE is becoming extinct, period.
Okay, so in that metaphor, the president is the broken vacuum cleaner and the hyenas are the cabinet.
And do you know I loved that sentence without even realizing what it literally meant?
Oh, thank you.
I believe that's called working on more than one level.
Yeah, look at me go.
Yeah. What else should we talk about? You're off Twitter, you said, still. I know that because I looked for you.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
There's an imposter. It's very strange.
What do you mean?
There's like a fake Lindy West on Twitter.
What's the handle called?
It's some weird nonsense, but they copied everything else from my old profile. So it's like my picture, my bio, and then they just copied and pasted a bunch of my old tweets. So people think that it's me. It's really weird.
But they're tweeting anew?
Not really. They don't seem to really do anything.
Well, that's like just a tribute then.
I guess so. I guess. Wow. I can't tell what's in it for them. But anyway, if you are trying to contact me via that string of gibberish, which I can't remember what it is, it's not going to, you're out of luck. But yeah, you know, I quit Twitter in January because it just was eating up too much of my emotional energy and time.
And this is a big deal to some people. To a lot of people, it would be a big deal, but you had however many thousands of followers.
Yeah, I think about 100,000 followers.
And it was a big decision.
It was a big decision. It's a big part of, as a writer, you are told that, your success in your career depends on marketing yourself on social media. So Twitter is a huge platform. I had a huge reach and it was really scary. But it was also sucking up a lot of my creative energy. It was really, you know, when you're an outspoken feminist writer or really any kind of writer who writes about, inequality and oppression and marginalization, you are just bombarded 24/7 with hate and abuse. And it is psychologically taxing. And I found that it was interfering with my ability to do my best work. And
why was somebody else's opinion interfering with your work?
Well, it's not their opinion. It's that it's busy work. It's like I had to spend hours every day blocking people and reporting people and screen capping things so that, you know, just in case this person turns into a credible threat. And and also, you know, it does emotionally when you have 100 people a day telling you that you're trash sometimes, or sometimes overtly threatening you.
Can you hire someone to read it for your safety and then just not read it at all?
Yeah, that's what like really famous people do. Like that's what Lena Dunham does. And, you know, I'm sure lots of other celebrities, but
you have 100,000 followers. You are the author of Shrill. You are a New York Times contributing opinion writer. I think you rate Lena Dunham's person.
Yes, but I don't
ask Lena Dunham to share her for him.
I would love to, but no, I mean, if I ever can afford it, I would love to have a Twitter surrogate.
Okay, listeners, GoFundMe account. Yeah. Buy Lindy West a, what do you call it? Our social media producer just volunteered herself for job.
You really don't want to do that.
No, that would be like, I know somebody who, I don't want to get into that, but it's like, there are jobs, horrible jobs people have that involve finding horrible things on the internet.
And
you don't want that.
No.
You won't be surprised to know. What else? So you're on Facebook.
I'm on Facebook. Okay. I have a public Facebook account. If you want to come say hi, feel free. I have an Instagram, which I love. It's very peaceful there.
Is that just photos?
Yeah.
Nothing but photos? No text on Instagram,
I mean, you
right?
can put a caption on your photo.
Uh-oh.
Horrible
captions?
You could put horrible captions if you want.
Do people do that?
Probably. But not on... for some reason, I don't get any guff on Instagram. And I have a Snapchat. I finally figured that out. Finally cracked the Snapchat.
Snapchat is basically funny pictures. They're like art shopped.
Yeah. Snapchat is like, so I have two teenagers.
Yeah.
They only communicate on Snapchat.
Yeah.
They barely text.
Yeah.
They don't email. They don't have Facebook. They don't have they kind of have Twitter, but it's just Snapchat. So, you know, it's just basically a messaging app, except you can take selfies and make them look ridiculous.
And you can't get trolled on Snapchat.
I mean, I guess you could, but I have mine set so that no one can contact me, which is really my ideal social media experience.
What else do you want to do in the New York Times, Lindy?
Well, I mean, it's pretty amazing to have a direct line to the president. Like, you know that he hate reads the failing New York Times.
Has he ever reacted to you personally?
No, but that's my goal.
Okay.
How amazing would it be if, like, I could annoy the president so much that...
Would you go on Twitter if it meant he would tweet your handle? Like, because he seems to like to fight personally.
That's true. How would he get in touch with me?
Yeah.
If I knew that the president wanted to get in touch with me and give me his opinion of my work, I would make a brief return to Twitter.
But you know, he could go Rosie O'Donnell on you or something.
Oh yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, it is. Would you want to interview Donald Trump if you could?
Sure. Just to be a part of this moment in history.
What would you ask him?
What is wrong with you? Hey, man.
John Kelly just said that to him yesterday.
I'm sure. What's the plan here? I don't know.
What's the big picture?
What is the big picture? I don't know. I mean, it's...
Can you say anything nice about Donald Trump? Since, you know, because shared humanity?
Because of shared humanity, you know, it's really hard.
Syllables say it all.
Because at a certain point, when someone is causing so much mayhem and death and destruction and potentially the end of human life, do I care if they, you know, get the stomach flu? Not really.
Yeah.
I mean, if he was like vomiting in front of me, I would say, hey, buddy, do you want some water?
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's a start.
Yeah.
Let's begin there.
That's very...
Let's begin with the vomit water.
I'm a real humanitarian.
As we unite this country. maybe one more thing. It reminds me, you often call on white liberals to march. which is something we discussed last week on the show. And we got I got an email from Mark who said, "Panelists who lament that more people aren't activists taking to the streets fail to understand that the presence of Antifa scares nonviolent Trump protesters away." Any sympathy for scared?
No.
No.
No. Oh, sorry. I mean, first of all, every person that I know who's been, you know, at the protests in Berkeley, you know, the protests where there's been a big Antifa presence, has said that the vast overwhelming majority of the protests were constructive and peaceful. And, you know, it's really a lot of disproportionate media focus on small incidents of violence. And so, you know, I think, my God, I mean, if you're genuinely perturbed by the direction that our country is going, go do something. It just seems like we can use a little bit of perspective here.
Lindy West, I asked you that last question with only seconds left.
Oh.
Because I'm a terrible interviewer, but you're a wonderful writer. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you again. Author of Shrill, contributing New York Times opinion writer. Please come back soon.
I'd love to.
Lindy West on the record. More coming up. Still on Twitter, at KOW, it's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I just took a break from Googling Lindy West phrases, and I Googled the phrase, America's Most Famous Librarian. And I found a list starting with Ben Franklin, co-founder of our library system. Oddly, though, Mao Zedong was on there, and Golda Meir, and Marcel Duchamp, and Marcel Proust, and Laura Bush. And at number 25 on this list, Seattle's Nancy Pearl, author of the Book Lust series, and now her first work of fiction. KUOW's Marcy Silman asked Nancy what her new novel, her first novel, George and Lizzie, is about.
Let me just preface that by saying that I've had, of course, as you know, we have spent like almost two decades together talking about what books are about and why people will like them. It was always easy. Talking about George and Lizzie is so hard for me, and trying to figure out what to say about it. So briefly, I think it's a character-driven novel about this young couple who really inhabit very different psychological worlds, and their meeting and their developing relationship, and what keeps them together and what drives them apart.
It's fair to say, I'm not giving anything away, to say they get married.
Yes.
Because that's important, too.
That is important.
Did you ever consciously decide that you were going to write a novel?
You know, I didn't. George and Lizzie came to me one night when I couldn't fall asleep, and these two characters just really came into my head almost fully formed, in the sense that I knew their names were George and Lizzie. I knew Lizzie's last name, Boltman. I knew that they met at a bowling alley in Ann Arbor, and that's all I knew about them. And that was about 7 years ago. And I just started thinking about them all the time. You know, it was like whatever else I was doing, I was living this duo life with George and Lizzie, and having Lizzie comment on what I was doing. You know, I would walk by the sorority houses on 17th, and I would think, you know, I could hear Lizzie saying, "Well, would my life have been any different if I had joined a sorority in college?" And you know, I would eat a cookie, and I would think, "Well, this is a cookie Lizzie would like to dunk in her tea." I mean, gradually over the next like 4 years, I really learned so much about them, and so by the time I sat down to write, I just was. It was like I was debriefing my head. It was all there. And so in many ways, I feel like I didn't make any decisions, that the decisions, you know, had all, they were real people to me.
Now, Nancy, you make it sound like that writing was so easy. But as you mentioned, I've known you for a couple of decades, and I happen to know that this was not a simple process for you.
It was not a simple process. And the reason it was not a simple process is because I'm this incredibly critical person, most critical about myself. And I would write a sentence. A sentence would be in my head that I'd thought about and rewritten in my head, and it would sound just right, you know, perfect, if I can use that word, perfect in my mind. And I would put it down, you know, I would type it into the computer, and there it would be on the screen, and that sentence would be lame. I mean, it would be nothing like the sentence in my head. And the example, the best example is once I typed, George took Lizzie's arm, and then I said, well, where did he take it? What did he, you know, what did she do with one arm? What did he do with the arm that he, you know, the extra arm? I mean, things that a reader would never, ever stop at a sentence like Lizzie, George took Lizzie's arm. So that was hard.
That sentence does not appear in the book.
No,
I read the book. I didn't see that sentence. No, I should just say, if you don't recognize her voice, I'm talking to librarian and novelist Nancy Pearl, and her new book is called George and Lizzie. Because this is about characters, George and Lizzie, and then there are some other characters, parents and friends are in this book as well. I have often heard, very often, that novelists are taking from their own lives when we're creating characters. So how much do George and Lizzie come from you, your husband, people you know?
So the novel is not autobiographical in any way, shape, or form. I do share with Lizzie, or maybe I should say Lizzie shares with me, some sort of superficial characteristics. We both love poetry. We both love the specific poets, Hausman and Larkin and Millay. And we both love football, although Lizzie has a love-hate relationship with football.
Well, in fact, that's something I did not know about
yes.
you. This is a book also about football. There are many football teams in this book.
Yes, right.
And football players.
Right. But you don't have to know anything about football no. or be even interested in football to enjoy the book, I think. So Lizzie shares those things with me. And George is, while he's not my husband, he shares much more with my husband than Lizzie, for example, does with me. George and my husband share a kind of Buddhist philosophy about living in the present, and that there is everything is an opportunity for growth. And that's something that Lizzie really has trouble believing.
Because, in fact, George is an optimist
right.
and Lizzie is not an optimist.
No, no. I'd like to describe Lizzie as the sort of person who, if you said, is this glass half full of water or is it half empty? Lizzie would say, that glass is totally empty and you're just imagining whatever water there might be in it. That's Lizzie. I think George at one point calls her a pathological pessimist. And Lizzie in return would say, well, George is a pathological optimist.
I should also say, because I do know you, that these characters inhabit places that you have inhabited.
Yes, they do. But again, you know, I lived in Ann Arbor for about altogether about 7 or 8 years. That's all. I lived in Tulsa, where George is from, for a long time. But I've lived in Seattle for longer than both. But it never occurred to me that it should be set. As I said, there just was no decisions to make. It just was, well, this is the way it is.
So the long process of living with George and Lizzie and then translating all of what was in your head to a novel, how did you feel when they actually sent you this book?
Yeah, it was the whole process has just been pretty remarkable. I was so lucky to find an editor and a publisher, Touchstone, which is part of Simon & Schuster, and the editor-in-chief of Touchstone, Tara Parsons, bought the book. And she was fabulous. The book has an unconventional, slightly unconventional narrative, the way it's told.
And you have to just read it because I can't describe it. So everybody should read this book. But I should mention, as I talk about books, is that you've published several other books
yes.
before this. But those are books that sort of come out of the profession and the practice of what you've done for years,
right.
which is try to get people to read.
Right.
So this is a really different thing.
It is. Interestingly enough, I often thought that the booklust books were people would say, well, you should write a memoir. But I'm never going to write a memoir. I mean, that's ridiculous. But the booklust books are really a record of my reading life. Mm-hmm. And especially the first one is so personal to me because every book in there was so meaningful and, played such an important role in my life. But George and Lizzie, I mean, that, while it's not personal in that particular way, it's utterly me. And I was fortunate enough to be able to read the audio book.
Really?
So, yes.
Oh, fine.
And so, because the narrator, who is a sort of close third-person narrator, is me. And you know, I'm sure you could hear echoes of me telling the story of George and Lizzie and their family and friends.
Well, so then this is thrilling for you. I mean, I'm looking at you.
I know.
And this is.
I know.
It's
thrilling and it's so scary. It's so anxiety provoking because, you know, I want people to love George and Lizzie the way that I do. And not the book, but I mean, those people, I want them to, when the last page is turned, my hope would be that people would still think about what's going to happen to them. Because there are still questions left unanswered at the end of when you turn the under 300 page.
Yes, many questions. Although it is, for me, it was a page turner. And I have to say, you mentioned this at the start or alluded to this at the start. For decades, you have come here and gone all over the world, helping readers discover books by asking them what they like to read and
right.
then helping recommend. So I'm going to turn the tables
yes.
right now.
I knew it.
I recommend George and Lizzie to people who love books by Eleanor Lipman
yes.
and Stephen McCauley and creators of well-developed, slightly neurotic characters who live in worlds filled with humor as well as challenge.
I absolutely. And Stephen McCauley was lovely enough to read the novel, and he loved it as well. And that meant so much to me because I adore Stephen McCauley's books. And of course, Eleanor Lipman, you and I share a great love of her novels as well.
So I picked well.
Absolutely. Marcy, go for it.
Nancy Pearl, librarian, radio personality, novelist. Yay. Her new book is called George and Lizzie, and Nancy will launch her national book tour where else but the Seattle Public Library downtown. That's tonight, September 5th at 7 p.m. Thanks so much.
Oh, Marcy, thank you.
And thank you for listening to The Record. Tune in tomorrow. John Keister will be here from Almost Live, Seattle's nationally syndicated comedy show of the 80s and 90s. Tune in. We'll talk to you tomorrow.